Utamaxim, garbage in, garbage out. It was only a matter of time before he and his team successfully built more technology into the system to take account of the cheapskate companies that deployed low-grade CCTV and never bothered updating it, and then expected law enforcement agencies to work miracles with footage of such a lousy quality on occasion that it was impossible to decipher a tree from a lamppost, let alone one person from another. He sometimes wondered if they had ever even heard of digital. The added time and expense of companies not having up-to-date technology was costly in more ways than one. Even from analysis of a single foot position, the software had the capacity to pick someone out in a crowd with reasonable accuracy. When good quality footage was provided of a person actually walking, certainty of identification could be very high. The technology could help determine whether a person was or was not present at a crime scene. It not only looked for similarity, it assessed for dissimilarity too. It could be used to seek particular aspects of a person's gait, and the process of exclusion was a vital one. Fortunately, the quality of these images was good. The woman he was looking at was, without doubt, the same woman who had checked out of the Park Royal West. With a very satisfied smile on his face, he picked up his phone, sat back in his leather swivel chair, and called Roy Grace's mobile number. Chapter 27. Thursday, the 26th of February. Tooth didn't much like reading. He'd named Yosarian after a character in one of the few books he'd ever read all the way through, Catch 22. It held him because it captured pretty much what life in a war zone in the military had been like, in his personal experience. A lot of assholes fighting an unwinnable war. Mostly, he watched television. Recently, back home, he had been curiously fascinated by an English TV series, Downton Abbey, and the place he entered now was pretty much what he imagined a stately home in England would be like. Except, as he stepped out of the elevator, walking between two suits of armour into an oak-panelled hall, the walls hung with stern, gloomy old masters, he was on the ninth floor of a New York Park Avenue East apartment block. As the short, creepy-looking uniformed butler bowed unctuously, he could smell cigar smoke and fresh coffee. Two large goons materialized, all in black, with earpieces on coiled cables, and frisked him, removing the hunting knife strapped to his left ankle and the Heckler & Koch from his shoulder holster. Tooth stood, silent and sullen, until they had finished. He kept the weapons in a locker he rented in a storage depot in Brooklyn. He had weapons in storage lockers in several cities around the world.
"This way, please," the butler said.
Tooth did not move.
"I want a receipt," he said.
"You get them back when you leave," one goon said.
"I'm leaving now."
"I don't think so,"
the other goon said, producing a large Sig Sauer with a silencer attached. Tooth brought his left leg up hard between the goon's legs. As the man doubled up in pain, he grabbed the Sig, headbutted the second guard, then with his right foot delivered a roundhouse kick, swinging the instep through the man's knee, sending him crashing to the ground. As both guards lay on the floor in pain, Tooth covered them with a gun and said,
"Maybe you didn't hear me right. I said I'm leaving."
He recovered his own gun and the knife, reholstering them.
"Please, Mr. Tooth," the butler said, "Mr. Egoroff would really like to talk to you."
"Yeah. Well, I'm here."
The two men stared at each other for some moments. Then the butler said,
"Mr. Egoroff is unable to walk."
Tooth remembered. His client had been shot by someone he'd upset, paralyzing him from the waist down. He tossed the Sig on the floor contemptuously towards the two goons, then followed the butler. Tooth didn't do art, but the long corridor he walked down was hung with oil paintings of landscapes, piles of dead game, and portraits of stiff-looking men and women, all in ornate gold frames that he figured hadn't come from a garage sale. He was ushered through double doors into a grand room with curtains held back with tasseled ties, antique furniture, and more paintings adorning the walls. Four men sat at a long dining table which was laden with silver baskets full of croissants, decanters of orange juice, silver coffee pots, plates, and tiny pots of jam. Three of them, who all looked faintly Neanderthal, though dressed in business suits, stared at him warily. The fourth, Sergei Egoroff, was in a wheelchair. He had cropped fair hair, a massive gold medallion visible inside his white shirt, which was unbuttoned to his navel, and a large cigar with a white band in his hand.
"Ah, Mr. Tooth, good to see you," he said.
Unsmiling, and without acknowledging the greeting, Tooth strode across the floor towards him. He sat down at one of the empty spaces at the table, looked at each of the three Neanderthals in turn, as if they were small piles of dog shit that he needed to step over, then turned to the man who had hired him, Sergei Egorov, staring him in the eyes as he reached for a coffee pot. Instantly, the butler was at his side, pouring it.
"What would you like to report to us?" Egorov said. "It's fucking cold here."
Egorov laughed loudly. He waved his arms expansively, and each of his goons laughed too. Then all around the table fell silent.
"Anything else?" "Walt Klein's funeral is tomorrow. A service at Riverside Memorial Chapel at 76th and Amsterdam, followed by a committal at Greenwood Cemetery, Brooklyn."
"And you will be there? You haven't found this woman yet?"
Egorov asked.
"Why not?"
"I've been to every hotel in this city where she might be staying," Tooth replied. "So far, no."
"Why not?
Like I told you before, she's not here anymore."
"It's her fiancé's funeral. You don't think she'll be there for appearances?"
"Well, that's what I thought at first, but now I don't think so."
"Why would she be?"
Tooth replied.
"Klein's family despise her. She's not going to inherit a cent. I think she's back in England, as I've already told you."
Tooth pulled his cigarettes from his pocket and tapped one out. He put it in his mouth and lit it.
"It's a week now," Egorov said. "Are you trying hard enough?"
Tooth sipped the coffee the butler had poured. Then he looked back at his paymaster.
"Give me your bank account details."
"My bank account details? Why?"
"I don't like you."
Tooth looked at the other three.
"You can always judge a man by the friends he keeps. You keep shit company."
All three bodyguards stirred, and it took a sharp hand in the air by Egorov to calm them.
"I'll repay you the million. No charge for expenses. You don't want to listen to me? Fine. I'm gone."
"Okay, okay," Egorov said. "I'm listening to you."
Tooth eyed him for some moments. He was also weighing up just what this job meant to him. He needed the money, so he held his temper as much as he could.
"What part of 'she's not here anymore' don't you understand?"
"Mr. Tooth, we need back what this woman has. We need that memory stick. Don't bother about the cash. It's counterfeit. And we'd like you to teach that woman a lesson, you understand? One of your lessons. We'd like to see it, too."
He raised one hand in front of his eyes, and with the other made a cranking motion, miming filming.
"If it's so important to you, who the hell entrusted that Romanian moron with it?"
"It is really important," Egorov said, ignoring the question and puffing on his cigar. "I want you to go to the funeral. If she's not there, fine. That's my bad call. Then you go to England, get the memory stick, and kill the bitch. I'm told you are good at filming the death of your targets. We'd really enjoy seeing that film. Understand what I'm saying?"
Tooth hesitated. He didn't like dealing with assholes who didn't listen to him. They were the people who got you caught. But he needed the money. These assholes were good paymasters. If he upset them, maybe they'd badmouth him. Maybe business would dry up totally. He stared back at Egorov as if watching a poker opponent, then said,
"Your dollar. Your call."
Chapter 28, Thursday, the 26th of February. It was 5:30 p.m. and pelting with rain outside his window. Roy Grace shuffled together a bunch of papers on the prosecution he was preparing for Dr. Edward Crisp's eventual return to the UK, which he was going to take home and read later this evening. Then he stared at the screensaver on his phone, a picture of Noah and Cleo outside the front of their new home. He was looking forward to getting back in good time to play with Noah before bed, and then enjoy a drink and a meal with Cleo. There was a knock on his office door.
Come in!
Following Hayden Kelly's report, he had, the day before, asked Jack Alexander to find out urgently from the US authorities what he could about Jody Bentley's movements at Atlanta Airport. Had she or Judith Forshaw travelled anywhere else within the USA, or did their system show Jody Bentley leaving the country? The DC came in, beaming, clutching a wadge of papers on which were rows of names, as well as the blurry, blown-up image of the suspect woman's face from CCTV footage at Atlanta Airport, and a memory stick, which he put down on the detective superintendent's desk. Grace indicated a chair in front of him.
"Sir," Jack said, sitting down, "I found out that Jody Bentley appears to have travelled from Washington Dulles to Hartsfield-Jackson Airport at Atlanta using the name Gemma Smith. She then flew out of Atlanta as Jody Bentley on a Virgin Airlines flight to Heathrow last Thursday at 17:35, scheduled to arrive in London at 6:30 a.m. on Friday the 20th. I've obtained her address from her credit card details."
"Where does she live?"
"Now we get to the interesting bit, sir," Alexander said. "I've checked it out. It's a rental mailbox address, the same as she used when she booked into the Park Royal West in New York."
"What did you find out about it?"
"I've been to see them, and spoke to the manager, who wasn't too helpful, until I threatened her with a search warrant."
Grace smiled. He liked this detective's attitude. He reminded him of himself at that age. Alexander continued.
"She said they'd never met the woman. It was all set up via email about a year ago. A Hotmail account, naturally. I've given it to the high-tech crime unit to see if they can find out any information, but they're dubious. Donald Duck could set up an untraceable Hotmail account in a couple of minutes."
"How did she pay for this mailing address?" Grace quizzed him.
"In cash, apparently. Delivered by a cab."
"So she was planning in advance," Grace commented, thinking hard. "Who the hell is this woman?"
"Who picks up her mail?" "The manager says that the staff change all the time, and none of the current employees have any recollection of dealing with her."
"Jody Bentley," Grace thought.
"Have you checked the electoral register?" "Yes, I have. There's no one of that name."
"Nice work, Jack."
"Thank you, sir. Sounds to me like she doesn't want to be found."
Grace smiled. "You don't say."
"I checked with the Border Control Agency at Heathrow. Her passport was scanned at 7:35 a.m. It would have been flagged if it had been recorded as lost or stolen, or if it had been a poor forgery. Apparently, forged passports often won't scan, as forgers don't always get it absolutely right."
"Do they retain information from these scans?"
"No, sir."
"Great. Why the hell not?"
"I don't know, sir."
They both looked at the blurry photograph again for some moments, then the DC continued, picking up the memory stick.
"I went up to the CCTV control room at Heathrow to see if I could track Jody Bentley's movements after passing through passport control. I've got her heading to the escalator down to baggage reclaim, but then she vanishes."
"Vanishes?"
"Possibly she went into a toilet and changed her hair and put on a different hat. On this stick, I've got the footage from the arrivals hall, but I couldn't see her on it. There's a dozen or so women of similar build emerging into it, but none of them that look like her or are dressed like her. She had three large suitcases on a trolley at Atlanta Airport. She must either have got a porter or another trolley at the carousel."
"What about the taxi companies and limousine services at the airport?" Grace asked. "Any of those take a single woman to Brighton? Also, what CCTV footage is there of people outside the building?"
"I've put in a request for that footage, and I'm working through the taxis and limousines, sir."
Grace looked at the detective's eager face. "Well done."
"Thank you, sir."
Next, he called the Financial Investigations Unit at John Street Police Station. He spoke to Kelly Nichols and asked her to see if she could find anything on a woman, aged in her 30s, from the Brighton area, who had recently been in the United States, going under the name of Jody Bentley, Judith Forshaw, or Gemma Smith. Then he went home. Chapter 29. Thursday, the 26th of February.
"Yes, yes, 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 oh, yes, yes, oh my God, you are incredible, yes, 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 oh, oh, oh!"
Jody screamed in ecstasy, or rather, what she hoped sounded like ecstasy. She clawed her nails down Rollo Carmichael's naked back as, crushing her with his weight, he kept on thrusting as deep inside her as his not very well endowed and slightly flaccid penis would go. She shot a discreet glance at her wristwatch. Only 3 minutes had elapsed. Too soon. She'd been right in her original assessment of Carmichael. While he wasn't a lawyer or a banker, he had been a Mayfair art dealer in a very serious way. The impressionists he'd dealt in ranged in value up to figures with ridiculous rows of noughts at the end. He had a house in Knightsbridge, which he used just as an occasional pied-à-terre, and which, from the address she had managed to get out of him, she had discovered on the internet to be worth a good 10 million. And his main home was now here in the city, this beachfront house, valued at more than £3 million. If she played her cards right, this could truly be the catch that set her up for life. And he had excitedly invited her to join him on an exotic cruise he'd booked. He was flying out on Saturday afternoon. He had no one to go with. Could she possibly drop everything and join him? Please. He'd apologized earlier for not having any Viagra tablets. She'd whispered to him, very sensually, that she would consider herself quite a failure if she couldn't arouse him without them. Now, as he continued, as heavy as an elephant, grunting with grim determination, clammy with perspiration, his breath sweet with alcohol, she was reminded of a description by the former girlfriend of a grossly overweight MP, who had said that making love to him was like having a wardrobe fall on top of her with the key still in the door. That was sort of what it felt like now. To distract herself, she thought about the different techniques of her past lovers, if that was the right word for her conquests. Walt Klein, fortunately, never lasted more than a few seconds before coming. Before him, Martin Granger, short and wiry, had used a curious rocking motion, as if drilling a borehole. And before him, God, Ralph Portman was big on what he thought was erotic foreplay, repeatedly biting her nipple so hard she screamed in pain. She glanced at her watch again. Coming up to 4 minutes. A respectable time. She needed him to feel a man, to believe that he was satisfying her, because that would make him feel so good. Their first time, in this gorgeous house with huge bay windows overlooking the sea, champagne in the ice bucket on the coffee table. Alcohol. Alcohol made these things bearable, doable, and, just occasionally, although not right now, enjoyable. It was their second date this week. She had a 3-date rule, she told him cheekily when he'd made advances after their first dinner just 2 days ago, on Tuesday. He would have come down to see her again last night, he told her, but he had to attend some tedious city livery dinner, of which he was on the court, whatever that meant. She was still fretting about the break-in at her house. Although the house had an alarm, she never set it, because the last thing she wanted was having to have key holders and the risk of the police going in and snooping around should it be set off. Hopefully this was nothing more than some low-life intruder taking advantage of the easy access via the scaffolding. Shit, the sore-scaled viper and the poisoned dart frog could have escaped out into the open, although in this cold air they wouldn't have survived for long. Luckily they were still there, and she'd managed to put them safely into new vivariums. She had been so angry, her first impulse had been to call the police, but she had worked hard to preserve her anonymity, and just had to swallow it. As well as the fact, of course, that keeping these creatures without a local license was illegal. She had bought some of them at poisonous reptile shows in Houten, in Holland, and at Ham, in Germany. Bringing them into England in their little cardboard boxes was always easy. She just walked straight through immigration with them inside duty-free carrier bags. She hoped the little bastard, or bastards, had been bitten. Serve them bloody right. It did occur to her this break-in might be connected to the memory stick and cash, but if that had been the case, the house would have been turned upside down. She doubted they'd have been put off by her reptiles. She'd been fascinated by venomous reptiles ever since she was a small child, and an uncle had given her a book on wild animals. The furry and fluffy ones hadn't interested her at all, but the snakes, spiders, crocodiles and frogs had. Other girls her age played with dolls. She kept snakes. Probably another reason, she had often reflected, why her father found her strange. Her snakes never minded that she had a big hooked nose and no tits. One evening, she put one of her grass snakes beneath the sheets at the bottom of Cassie's bed. Then she had lain in her own room and waited for the screams. They had sounded so sweet, so beautiful, totally worth having the snakes confiscated the next day. She'd met her first husband, Christopher Bentley, in the reptile house of London Zoo when she was 22. He was 48 and recently divorced. A few months before meeting him, she'd left home and used all her savings, together with a fake credit card, which she managed to use for a few weeks to draw out sums of cash, to have a Harley Street nose and chin job, followed by a boob job. Having made a small fortune in property early on and not needing to work again, Christopher's big interest was venomous reptiles. He had spent a considerable amount of his adult life travelling in India, Africa, and South America, where he had developed a fascination for these creatures. He had written 2 books on venomous snakes and 1 on poison frogs, and had been the advisor on setting up reptile houses at several zoos in the UK. She'd found him fascinating too, and attractive. The first time she entered his own private reptile house, in the basement of his handsome Regent's Park home, a stone's throw from the zoo, she was captivated. The walls were lined with glass showcases, housing a huge collection of deadly snakes, spiders, and frogs. He knew so much about all of them, and delighted in sharing his knowledge. He had rattlesnakes, a death adder, a gaboon viper, a saw-scaled viper, a tiger snake, and a whole variety of black mambas, as well as a range of spiders, including redbacks and funnel webs. He also had a fascination with scorpions, keeping Indian reds, death stalkers, and Arabian fat-taileds. They excited her. She was awed by the power these small creatures had. The ability to kill a human being with a single bite or sting, or in the case of some frogs, just contact with their skin. Christopher told her, too, that a scorpion, unhappy with its environment, or surrounded by a ring of fire, could commit suicide by stinging itself in the back of its neck. She liked that. The thought that if she wasn't happy, she could just go, "I'm out of here," and end it all. She figured she would, one day. But not yet. Not, hopefully, for a long time. She was enjoying life, and had plans. Big plans. He had shown her the cabinet of meticulously labelled antidotes for the bites and stings of each of these creatures, and how to administer them, and in what time frame before paralysis or death. Most importantly of all, he taught her how to use the various implements he kept to handle his collection. Mostly they were very basic, and the snakes he tended to handle with a metal stick, like a skewer with a curved end, and his bare hands. On that first day, he took her to his reptile room to show her a new arrival, a small cardboard box sealed with gaffer tape containing a saw-scaled viper, which he cheerily told her had killed more people in the world than any other snake. It lived in Africa, the Middle East, Pakistan, India, and Sri Lanka. It was extremely aggressive, he said, and moved fast, coiling and uncoiling in a sidewinder motion, making a sizzling sound as its scales moved together. She was astonished to watch him pull away the gaffer tape with his bare, ungloved hands and open up the box with his hooked metal stick. Then he upended it into a red plastic bin and slammed down a ventilated lid. She'd noticed that even he had looked nervous during this last part of the operation. "What's your fascination with these creatures?" she'd asked him. "Their power," he had replied simply. "Here we are, us humans, with all our sophistication, yet any of these creatures, some with brains the size of a pinhead, can kill us, some in hours, some in days." He had delighted in talking her through the biochemistry of their bites and stings, all the different ways that the venom acted on the human body without the antidote. For some reason, she found herself particularly drawn to the saw-scaled viper, the way its bite was fatal, and that there was only a 2-hour window in which to administer the antidote. Too bad, 8 years after they were married, that Christopher had missed an antidote window. Well, not strictly true. She'd jolted his arm when he'd been holding a saw-scaled viper by the neck, and she had previously substituted the antidote with a placebo. Hey-ho, so much for the so-called placebo effect. By the time he'd been admitted to the toxicology unit at Guy's in London, he was already bleeding through his eyes and every orifice. He'd had to go. He was adamant he didn't want to have children, and that didn't fit with her plans. And he wasn't rich enough for all the things she wanted in life, including a child. She wanted this more and more badly as time went on and her biological clock was ticking away. But two good things had come from that marriage. A substantial chunk of his estate, after death duties, enabling her to buy property, a house and a bolt-hole flat in Brighton, and another bolt-hole flat in London, and not to have to worry about money in the short term. And she'd also learned the importance of having a glass door into the reptile room, so you could see before entering if any of your pets were out of their containers. Just like she had at home. She glanced surreptitiously at her watch again. Enough time now. She began writhing, clawing wildly at him, and screamed out,
"Oh, my darling, yes, 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 I'm...
Suddenly, Rollo Carmichael shuddered, then stiffened in every part of his body except for the bit that actually mattered right now, which went limp and slipped out of her. She felt his whole weight on top of her, crushing her.
"Darling,"
she said. There was no reply.
"Rollo, did you..."
He let out a faint gasp of air.
"Rollo?"
Gripping his head, she turned his face towards hers. He stared dead ahead, unblinking. Nobody home.
"Rollo?"
she said gently. Then more loudly,
"Rollo? Rollo? No, don't do this to me! Rollo!"
There was no response. Chapter 30. Friday, the 27th of February. Jodie Bentley was a no-show, as Tooth had expected, as he had predicted, as he had told his paymaster, Sergei Egorov. If the Russian asshole had listened, Tooth wouldn't be standing in an icy wind in falling sleet, freezing his nuts off. He'd be on a plane back to New York from Brighton, England, with the memory stick that Egorov had paid him $1 million to recover. He always took his payment up front. He didn't need to do cash on delivery, because he always delivered. He stood in a fleece coat, fur-lined boots, and Astrakhan hat a short distance up the hill at Brooklyn's Greenwood Cemetery. At least, he figured, Walter Klein could take comfort in the fact that his casket was more luxurious than the jail cell he'd probably have spent at least the next 15 years in. A plane, taking off from LaGuardia, thundered overhead. He heard the distant clatter of a helicopter and the even more distant, mournful honk-honk of a fire engine. Below, the funeral cortege was leaving. A long line of black limousines. A grand cortege, he thought, for a scumbag whose assets had all been frozen. But Tooth wasn't here to judge the man. A siren wailed. Another plane roared overhead. He put a cigarette in his mouth, cupped his hand over his lighter flame, and lit it. He waited, smoking it down to the butt until the last vehicle had left the cemetery gates, then trampled it out in the grass. He walked back to his rental Ford, climbed in, started the engine, and put the heater on full blast. Then he drove out of the cemetery too. He headed to the storage depot where he deposited his gun and knife, then on to JFK Airport. He dumped the car at the sixth rental area in the parking lot, called his client from a payphone there, and updated him. "Go to England," Egorov instructed him. Chapter 31. Friday, the 27th of February. It was Angie's birthday. Shelby told her he'd been given the night off from his warehouse job by agreeing to work tomorrow, Saturday night instead, so he could take her out to celebrate. Angie had only recently moved to Brighton from landlocked Coventry, having split up with her partner, and she was enthralled by the novelty of living in a seaside resort. So, although he had no appetite today, he treated her to a fish-and-chip dinner with champagne at the Palm Court restaurant on the pier. As she sat opposite him, eating heartily, dousing her batter in salt and her chips in vinegar and ketchup, he sipped his glass of champagne and pushed his food around the plate, barely managing a couple of small mouthfuls.
"What's the matter, my sexy man? Not hungry?"
"My appetite's for you," he said with a forced smile. "You're making me so crazy for you, I can't eat."
He felt her foot, minus shoe, pressing between his legs.
"I like you being crazy for me," she said. "I want you always to be crazy for me."
He smiled again. He wasn't actually feeling that great, but he didn't want to spoil her big day. He finished his glass of champagne, called the waiter over, and ordered a pint of lager, hoping that alcohol would make him feel better. Hell, he'd splashed out on a taxi here so they could have a proper celebration, so might as well get his money's worth, he figured. He'd woken that morning to find a small swelling on his ankle, but nothing that bothered him too much. It didn't seem to have grown any bigger during the day, but he definitely wasn't feeling right tonight. Not 100%, not firing on all cylinders. He was a little giddy and a bit clammy, as if he had a touch of flu. Of course, that was probably thanks to the horrible ride Angie had insisted he take her on, the booster, before going to the restaurant. It had soared them up in the air, flipped them over, and then over again. And then, when he thought he couldn't take any more, they'd gone over yet again and again. His brain still felt as if it was revolving. Angie looked at him and frowned. She took a tissue out of her handbag, leaned forward, and dabbed his chin. "It's still bleeding." Shelby touched his chin where he'd nicked himself shaving earlier. He'd put a styptic pencil on the cut, which normally did the trick. But as he removed his hand, he saw fresh blood on his finger. He pressed the tissue to his chin, called a waitress over, and asked if she could find a small plaster for him. Then he downed the lager fast and ordered a second pint. Angie's plate was clean, he realized, as she picked up her last chip, mopped up the blob of ketchup on her plate, and popped it in her mouth.
"Was it the ride?"
she asked, chewing, looking at his huge, barely touched portion of cod. He nodded forlornly.
"Afraid so. Never been very good with them."
"Feeling queasy, are you?"
"A little," he admitted.
"I know a good cure for that."
He felt her foot pressed into his crutch, stroking from side to side.
"Mmm," she said. "I'm sensing some improvement."
He gave her a weak grin.
"Yeah, yeah, I'm sensing that too."
"I think I need to take you home to bed," she said.
"Well, the night is young," he said, evasively, unsure he could manage anything right now.
"My point exactly."
She wiggled her foot. He downed his second pint, hoping that might do the trick. It didn't. It sent him running to the toilets, where he threw up violently. Chapter 32. Friday, the 27th of February. Tooth sat in the back of the limo taking him to JFK Airport. Whenever possible, he took limousines in New York. He hated yellow cabs. He hated the often erratic nature of the drivers and the cramped rear quarters of many of the vehicles, sitting with his face pressed up against the scratched Perspex screen, having to endure an endless loop of advertising videos. He only took a yellow cab when he needed to. Like last Saturday. He wasn't looking forward to his shitty continental night flight to London in coach. He always flew coach, because no one took any notice of coach-class passengers. None of the cabin crew remembered them. And he had always survived by being a chameleon, by not being noticed or remembered, just as he had in his days as a sniper in the military. He was good at being patient, waiting. He had nothing else to do with his time. No one to care for or worry about, except Yusarian. And Yusarian was fine right now. Mama Missick would be spoiling the dumb mutt rotten. Just like himself, just like the dog, big old ugly Mama Missick didn't have anyone else in the world. They were three of a kind, stuck together, riding the carousel that was spinning at 1,040 miles per hour, this meaningless planet Earth, riding and waiting for oblivion. Well, Mama Missick was different. She was waiting to go to heaven. Luckily for her, Tooth figured, one day oblivion would take care of her disappointment. Tooth didn't do heaven. Chapter 33. The Past. It happened 18 years ago, but Jodie could remember it vividly. It was funny. Whatever her parents thought, Jodie found it funny, almost hysterically funny. It still brought a big smile to her face, a smile of glee, a smile of satisfaction, a smile at the whole ridiculousness of it all. But of course she hadn't dared to smile at that actual moment. She'd managed to look every bit as shocked as her parents. It was the first anniversary of Cassie's death. Her sister was receding into the past in both her memory and in the photographs around the house. She was pleased to see that the really big portrait photograph of her, the one that sat in its frame on the windowsill in the lounge, the one in which she looked so truly beautiful, was starting to fade significantly. There were so many photos of Cassie that the house had the feeling of a shrine. A shrine to Cassie, beautiful Cassie, Daddy's pet, Mummy's pet, teacher's pet, perfect Cassie. Jody often wondered whether, if it had been her instead of her sister, would there have been the same outpouring of grief, the same kind of shrine? She didn't think so. Neither of her parents noticed that she had discreetly moved the big photo from its original, shaded position into the bay window that got direct sunlight for hours. Already the colour was starting to leach out of her skin. In a while, Jody thought, she'll just look like a ghost, and that will be one less picture of her to haunt me. The family went to visit Cassie's grave that afternoon. Her father took the day off work. Her mother hadn't been back to work since Cassie died. She was still too distraught, still recovering after her breakdown from the shock.
"Come on, woman, get over it," Jody thought silently. "You believe in God. You go to church every Sunday, so what's your problem? Cassie's in heaven. She's probably the angel Gabriel's pet, Jesus's pet, God's pet."
Not that Jody believed in any of that stuff. She didn't think her sister was any of those things. In her view, Cassie was just a bunch of rotting, desiccated skin, bone and hair in a fancy coffin that was rotting too, 6 feet under, in the huge cemetery off the old Shoreham Road, where her grandparents were also buried. Best place for her.
"Good riddance,"
she thought privately as she stood sobbing and sniffing and pretending to be all sad that her sister was gone, cruelly snatched away, just as the wording said on her neat white headstone with a fancy carved script. "Cassie Jane Danforth, beloved daughter and sister, cruelly snatched away from us." Cruelly snatched. Well, that bit wasn't strictly accurate, she thought. Fell to her death whilst walking along a coastal cliff path on a family holiday in Cornwall during the October half-term. Pushed, actually. But that was another story. Best not to go there. Later that evening, home in bed, Jody wrote in her diary, "We went for a pub supper after visiting the grave. Mum was too upset to want to go home right away, and the poor thing was in no fit state to cook. So we drove out into the country to a gastro pub that Mum and Dad like, which serves the most horrid prawn cocktail I've ever eaten. Tiny little things, not much bigger than the maggots that are eating Cassie, and a lot of them still half frozen, and all smothered in a Marie-Rose sauce that's had a flavour bypass. Mum has it every time, and insists I should have it too. 'It's a very generous portion,' she always says. 'A very generous portion of cold maggots in ketchup-flavoured mayo. Can't believe I ordered it again tonight. It was even worse than before.' Even though he was driving, Dad drank 2 pints of Harvey's and ate a steak pie and beans and ordered a glass of red wine with it, a large glass. Mum had a small sherry, and they had an argument about who would drive. She insisted she would drive back. The food arrived, but I had to run out of the room and into the toilet to get away from the nauseating atmosphere. It was just so ridiculous. The whole day and evening. Mum's driving, for a start. She drives like an old woman. Well, she is an old woman, I suppose. 46 is pretty ancient. But she drives like she's 146, at a steady 46. She never goes over 50, not even on the motorway. She never overtakes anything, not even bicycles, unless she can see 10 miles of clear road ahead. She just sits behind them, irritating me. But not Dad. He even told her to slow down tonight. We were doing 15 miles per hour behind a bicycle, and he actually said to her, 'Susan, slow down, you're too close.' My family, my embarrassing family. The things they say. But this really made me laugh. Mum suddenly said she wanted to light a candle for Cassie, have it burning on the table with us during our meal. So my dad went up to the bar and asked if they had a candle they could light for his daughter. 10 minutes later, the chef and 2 other members of staff appeared with a small cake with a candle burning in the centre of it and walked towards us, all smiling at me and singing, 'Happy birthday to you.' I'm still laughing about that, even though it's nearly midnight and I've got homework to do for tomorrow that I've not even started yet.
But honestly, I have to say, I've not felt so great in a long time.
Chapter 34. Saturday, 28th of February. 6 hours late. An hour out of JFK, the flight had turned back because of a technical fault. They'd been deplaned and sat in the goddamn terminal for over 4 hours before finally boarding again. They'd originally been scheduled to land at 7 a.m. Now it was 1:30 p.m. Most of the day wasted. Standing in the long snaking queue for passport control at London's Heathrow Airport, Tooth yawned. He could stay awake for as long as he needed, and sometimes, concealed in enemy territory back in his days in the military, that meant staying awake for 48 hours or longer, waiting for a target to appear. But right now, he was looking forward to a few hours' sleep in the room he had booked at the Waterfront Hotel on Brighton Seafront. Maybe he was getting old. He'd stayed awake in his cramped economy seat at the back of the plane for the entire flight, planning what he needed to do when he arrived. Once the plane was taxiing at Heathrow and he was able to get an internet connection, he'd pulled up a street map of Brighton and Hove on his phone, reminding himself of the layout of the city, looking up the street Judith Forshaw had put down on the hotel registration form. Western Road. Was it a real or false address? Whatever. The news stories about Walt Klein said his fiancée was from Brighton, a city of just 275,000 people. New York was a city of 8.5 million people, and he never had a problem finding anyone there. It would be a slam dunk to find her in Brighton. He slipped his passport out of his pocket and checked the details he'd filled in on his immigration form. His name, for the purposes of this visit, was Mike Hinton. He didn't like travelling on false documents. They added a layer of risk that wasn't usually worth it. But with his recent history in Sussex, there would be a marker on his real name for sure. Hinton. Mike Hinton. Accountant. 10 minutes later, the immigration officer studied his passport, then asked him to remove his cap. Tooth lifted up the baseball cap, which he had pulled down low over his face, and gave the woman officer a pleasant smile, whilst trying to mask his concern that she had recognised him. She looked at his passport again, back at his face, back at his passport, then closed it and handed it back to him. "Have a nice day in the UK, Mr. Hinton," she said, and smiled back. Tooth stepped forward without replying and took the escalator down into the baggage reclaim hall where he had his hold all to collect. He didn't like to let it out of his sight, but some of its contents would have been confiscated if he'd tried to take it as carry-on baggage. When it arrived, he picked it up off the carousel and strolled across to the green exit channel, his laptop bag and hold-all both over his shoulder. He always travelled light. It was easier to buy clothes wherever he was and bin them before leaving. In 15 years of globe-trotting, he'd never owned a suitcase. And for most of his jobs, he was in and out of a place without even needing to unpack what little he had with him. New York had been an exception. He'd been stuck there far too long, because he'd had to deal with assholes. He was on his own here, just himself and a woman who thought she was smart. But clearly she wasn't that smart. She'd been engaged to a crook with frozen assets, and now she'd stolen, clumsily, something she could never sell, and for which she was going to die. Unpleasantly. Tooth didn't do pleasant deaths. Chapter 35. Sunday, the 1st of March. A friend of mine told me many years ago that the secret of life is to know when it's good, Rowley Carmichael said, his arm tightly round Jodie's waist, wind whipping their hair about their faces. And right now it's really good, incredibly good. She stared up into his eyes, her own sparkling brightly in the stern lights of the ship, as brightly as the stars above them, like gemstones in the velvety darkness of the warm night sky. Like the diamond engagement ring on the black velvet pad of the ship's jewellery store that he had bought for her just a few hours earlier, the price of which she had pretended not to notice, although she was already thinking of a couple of shops in Brighton's lanes where she would get a good price for it in a few weeks' time. I know it's corny, my darling, but I feel like that couple on the Titanic. Remember that film?
Jack and Rose, weren't they called? He said.
She nodded.
Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet.
Weren't they on the prow of the ship? He said.
Want to go up to the prow?
Here's fine.
Smiling, he raised his flute of vintage Roederer Cristal and clinked it against hers.
Cheers, my darling, to the future unsinkable Mrs. Rowley Carmichael.
Cheers to my unsinkable husband-to-be, she said, sipping her drink, then standing on tiptoe to kiss him.
A long, long lingering kiss, as they both leaned against the stern rail, whilst she struggled not to let her revulsion show. His mouth was slimy, and his tongue felt like a foraging rodent running amok inside her own mouth. 50 feet below them, the wake of the ship glistened with phosphorescence, before fading into the darkness of the Indian Ocean.
"I still can't believe you agreed to marry me," he said. "Incredible! We've only known each other properly for a few days." "I still can't believe you asked me," she replied with a smile.
"I couldn't be happier. It wouldn't be possible," he said.
Looking adoringly into his eyes, she was thinking that she could be much happier.
"Wouldn't it be romantic to be married on this ship?" she said.
"On this ship? You mean on board?"
She nodded enthusiastically.
"Yes. Wouldn't that be amazing? Just so romantic. I read somewhere that ship's captains can marry people."
"I love your wildness," he said. "How spontaneous you are. This is crazy. Okay, let's do it. Let's go and find the purser and ask him the procedure."
"God, I love you so much," she said. "I just love looking at you."
But as she continued staring at him, she suddenly realized who it was he reminded her of. That faint flash of recognition she'd had on their first date. Her father. Below her feet, she could feel the slight thrumming of the engines. She breathed in the scents of varnish, fresh paint, the salty tang of the sea and the occasional whiff of diesel fumes. It was their first night at sea. The first port of call for the MS Organza, after departing her moorings in Dubai's Port Rashid cruise terminal earlier that morning, was Mumbai in 3 days' time. She was a handsome ship, resplendent in her gleaming white livery, barely 1 year old, carrying 350 passengers, and from the sharp service, it felt like there was double that number of crew. Rollo had already booked a 4-week leg of a round-the-world cruise on the ship before they'd met. It hadn't taken much persuading for her to join him. She'd gone home in the early hours of Friday morning to pack her bags for the cruise, and then had taken her cat to board again at Corrie Collie's kennels. Tyson hadn't been too happy about that, but then again, he was never too happy about anything. He'd get over it, and she'd make it up to him on her return. She'd also set up the timed feeds for the rest of her menagerie. Their cabin was a glorious suite, with a balcony.
"Did you remember to take your insulin, my love?" she asked.
He patted the pocket of his white tuxedo, then pulled out the blue Novo Rapid injector.
"Yep."
He put it carefully back in his pocket.
"You gave me such a scare the other night. I thought I'd lost you, before I'd even properly got to know you. What do you remember about it?"
"Well, not much. It was a blur. That happens if my sugar levels get too low. I'm not able to think straight, and then I pass out. It was my fault. I thought we were going to have some dinner, so I'd taken my jab and pill. Then, somehow, we never got as far as the door."
She grinned.
"So it was my fault, really? I couldn't wait until after dinner. I had to have you then and there, right there. But, Jesus, I got so scared when you collapsed on me. The paramedics were really concerned when they arrived. You were delirious. Then I got really angry with you when you refused to let them take you to hospital. I just needed sugar. I was fine. God, the thought of dying and losing you when we've only just met."
She reached up and kissed him.
"Don't ever do that to me again. Promise?"
"I think I learned my lesson."
"Which is?"
"That when we're in the bedroom together, it's impossible to keep my hands off you."
"Don't ever let that change."
"I won't."
He caressed her hair, running his fingers through her ringlets.
"Good.
You know, I still can't believe we met. I mean,
We have so many things in common. Our love of art, opera, theatre, food, wine, and travel. Do you believe in soulmates, my darling? He asked.
I didn't. Until I met you. But that's how you make me feel.
Me too. I think we met before in a previous life, and now we've found each other again.
It's how I feel exactly, she lied, sweetly.
Chapter 36. Sunday, the 1st of March. Shelby had stayed in bed all Saturday, vomiting regularly and with an intermittent nosebleed. He'd vomited several times more during the night. He woke, groggily, to see a concerned-looking Angie standing over him, dressed and holding a glass with a dark brown liquid in it.
"How are you feeling, my love?" she asked.
His head was swimming and he felt as if he was going to be sick again. His throat hurt from the acidic bile, which was all he had to puke up the last time some hours earlier.
"What's the time?" 10:30. It's Mum's 60th birthday today, remember?"
"Oh,
how do you feel? Do you want to come?"
Her parents lived in Watford. It was a good 2 to 2.5 hours' drive away. No way could he face that, nor her deadly dull mother, who didn't like him anyway. He shook his head slowly from side to side, feeling the roundabouts.
"I have to leave in a minute. Try to drink some of this."
She handed him the glass.
"What is it?"
"Coca-Cola. I've been stirring it to get the fizz out. The sugar in it'll do you good. You've got to get something down you. You need electrolytes. You didn't eat anything last night. This'll make you feel better."
She helped him sit up and stared strangely at his face.
"What?"
he asked.
"Where you cut yourself shaving, on Friday. It's bleeding again."
"It can't be."
"You must have knocked it and opened it up. I'll get a fresh plaster in a minute. First drink this."
She guided the glass into his hands and tilted it up towards his lips. He sipped a little and screwed up his face.
"Eugh."
"Trust me," she said. "This will make you feel better. You've got a tummy bug. There's a lot of it going around at the moment."
"I hope I haven't given it to you."
"I feel fine," she said. "I've prepared 2 more glasses of this. Try to drink one every few hours. It really will make you feel better."
"Coke," he said.
"Trust me. Coke was originally created for stomach ailments."
"You're kidding."
She shook her head.
"It was a medicine originally. Then people started to like the taste. I always drink it if I'm ill."
He sipped some more, dubiously, unsure if he would be able to hold it down, and after a few moments he realized it was actually making him feel a little less nauseous.
"Come on, get some more down. For me."
He took a larger sip, then another.
"Thank you, nurse."
She kissed him on the forehead.
"Don't go to work tonight. If you give me their number, I'll phone them and tell them you're still ill."
He shook his head.
"No, I'll see how I feel. I'll stay in bed and see how I feel later. I can't skip work again."
"I'll speak to them. Explain you're too ill."
He sipped some more coke.
"This is making me feel better. If I'm not right this afternoon, I'll ring the emergency doctor."
"Phone me if you're not feeling better, and I'll leave early and come back to you."
"You're an angel."
She grinned and kissed him again.
"I know."
"Bitch."
"You are feeling better, aren't you?"
"Come home as soon as you can. I have a feeling I might be really randy."
"Keep the feeling."
She waved him goodbye and slipped out of the bedroom. Moments later, she rushed back in with a plaster and handed it to him.
"Sorry, nearly forgot."
As soon as she was gone, he pushed back the duvet. He'd kept a bandage round his ankle, intending to tell Angie he'd cut it tripping over some boxes at work if she asked. Gingerly, he swung his legs over the side of the bed, leaned down and removed the bandage, and stared in shock. The skin around the bite was swollen, black and yellow, and weeping blood. Was it this that was making him feel so ill? A reaction to the snake bite? What had that thing been? He dabbed the wound with a tissue, found some antiseptic cream in the bathroom cabinet, applied some, and put on a fresh bandage. When he had finished, he opened his laptop and started searching snakes. All he could remember was that the snake was brown and had a black marking on it. There were dozens and dozens of different species and types. He stared at the images without recognition. He'd only seen it fleetingly in the beam of his phone torch. If it was truly poisonous, surely he'd be dead by now, he reasoned. Didn't poisonous snakes kill you within hours? It was 5 days now. Maybe the bite was infected, and he was suffering a reaction from that. He'd see how he felt later. Chapter 37. 14 years ago. The bandages had come off, and she looked like shit. Black eyes, her face blotched blue and red with bruises. But her nose was brilliant. The kink had gone, and now, instead, it was a perfect, small, straight nose. An exact copy of Cassie's. The surgeon had done a brilliant job, working from the photograph of her sister that she'd brought into the Harley Street Clinic for her first consultation, on both her nose and her chin. For the next 2 weeks, she barely ventured out of her small flat, which was a short distance back from the sea in Brighton's Kemp Town. And when she did, she was glad of the biting cold, because she could wrap part of her face in a scarf, mask her eyes with dark glasses, and keep a cap pulled low. Every day, checking in the mirror, the bruising was fading. The sculpting of her jaw the surgeon had performed was a masterpiece. Every day an increasingly beautiful woman was developing in the mirror, like a photograph in a darkroom tank, steadily coming to life. Like the photographs of Cassie, she studied daily, holding them beside her face in the mirror. As the scars faded, a more and more perfect image of Cassie appeared. She had blown almost every penny of her childhood savings on this series of operations on her face and body, including money she had stolen over the years from her parents, as well as money she'd drawn out on the fake credit card she'd obtained, and it had been totally worth it. And it was worth all the hard work waiting tables at a bistro in Hove in order to be free of her parents and independent. They might have rejected her throughout her childhood as the ugly duckling while they doted on Cassie, poor, long-dead Cassie, but she hadn't finished with them. A few weeks later, early on a Sunday evening, when she was certain her parents would be in, Jodie drove in her Mini to Burgess Hill. She hadn't seen them for months, ignoring the messages her mother left from time to time and declining her request to spend Christmas with them. Instead, she'd spent the day alone in her bedsit, binging on movies she'd been storing up to watch, getting smashed on Prosecco and stuffing her face with a ridiculously large Chinese takeaway. She decided it was the best Christmas she'd ever had. She parked outside the family house and walked past her mother's shiny new Audi, freshly washed and cleaned, no doubt by her father earlier today, and rang the front doorbell. The stupid triple ding-dong, ding-dong, ding-dong chimed. Inside, very faintly, she could hear the television. Then the door opened and her mother stood there in a baggy jumper, jeans and slippers, and just stared. She heard her father's voice above the sound of the television in the living room. "Who is it? Are we expecting anyone?" Her mother continued staring straight at Jodie, as if she was staring at a ghost. Then she began shaking and called out in tears, her voice quavering, "Alistair! Alistair!" Jodie stood and stared back. Her hair was dyed blonde and styled, from one of the photographs she had taken away, exactly the way Cassie's was on the day she died. Her father came out into the hall in loose-fitting brown cords and a blue V-neck over a pink shirt. He stopped in his tracks when he saw her, doing a double take.
"Oh, my God! What have you done, Jodie?"
her mother said.
"Why? Why have you done this?"
"Oh," Jodie said, as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. "You know, Sunday afternoon. Hey, just thought I'd swing by as I hadn't seen you guys in a while." Her father stepped forward into the doorway, livid with rage. "This is some kind of very sick joke, Jodie." Jodie shrugged.
"Oh, I see. You don't like my new look?"
"You nasty little bitch," he spat back. "You'll never change. Never. Just go away. Get away from our house. Get out of our sight. Your mother and I never want to see you again." Chapter 38. Sunday, the 1st of March.
It had been after 3 in the afternoon by the time Tooth had finally got to his hotel yesterday. He'd chosen this place because it was large and central, the kind of hotel he liked, where no one would take too much notice of him. When he'd checked in, the lobby had been filled with men and women in business attire, each wearing a name badge sporting a company logo, all milling around, as if taking a break from whatever conference they were attending. He was tired when he finally reached his room, and he knew it was dangerous to do too much when you were tired. That's when you made mistakes. So he just unpacked his few items, showered and changed into fresh clothes, went outside and smoked a cigarette, then returned to his room and crashed out. He woke at 2 a.m., hungry, ate some chocolate from the minibar, then sat at the desk, flipped open the lid of his laptop, logged on to the hotel Wi-Fi and checked for emails. There weren't any. He wasn't expecting any. The email address he used, routed via 5 different Eastern European countries, was impossible for anyone to trace, and he changed the address every week. The only emails he got were replies to ones he sent. He closed the lid and looked at the 2 photographs of the woman from the lobby of the Park Royal West Hotel. A good-looking woman, with some style. Jodie Bentley or Judith Forshaw. Where was she? This city wasn't on the scale of New York. If she was here, he would find her. All he had to do was recover the memory stick and teach her a lesson. Then he could head home. It wasn't that long since he had last been here, and he could remember the geography of the city pretty well. And there was something that bothered him. The address he had for the woman, which she had given when registering in New York, was Western Road. From memory, it was a mix of shops and residential flats. He googled the road, and that confirmed it. A curious place for a woman like this to live. He imagined her, from her lifestyle, residing in a more ostentatious part of town. Perhaps this was a false address. He wondered whether to put on his tracksuit and go out jogging and find it. His brain was wired, but his body felt leaden. He went back to bed and tried to sleep. A siren wailed outside. He heard drunken laughter in the corridor. He gave up after a while, got up and went for a run in howling, salty wind and pelting rain, then returned to the hotel. 8 hours later, wrapped in the padded anorak he'd bought in New York and wearing a baseball cap, Tooth paid the streamlined taxi driver with a £10 note, telling him to keep the change. Light rain was falling. It was freezing. He was tired. Jet lag. His body clock was all messed up. The route on his early morning run had included where he was right now, 23A Western Road, the Brighton Barista. Was there any shop in this goddamn rain-sodden city that wasn't a coffee house? He entered. Admittedly, the place had an enticing smell. It was furnished with a number of tables, each with computer terminals. A single saddo sat at one, and a couple of men in bad jeans, bomber jackets and baseball caps sat at another by the front window. Could they be plainclothes cops, surveying the passers-by? He looked at them again, and decided not. He walked to the rear of the shop. There was a drinks menu on the wall, and beneath it a display of cupcakes, a carrot cake, and assorted panini under a glass counter. Behind the counter stood a bored-looking woman in her 20s, with a face that might have been prettier if it wasn't caked in makeup and her blonde hair hadn't been styled by Medusa, he thought. "I'm looking for 23A Western Road," he said. "Uh-huh. You found it?" She sounded like she'd rather be defrosting a fridge or watching paint dry than having to talk to him, or anyone. She had 2 black sticks in her hair. Tooth wondered for a moment how she would feel having them stabbed through each of her eyes. "I've come to pick up mail for my girlfriend, Jodie Bentley. She also uses the name Judith Forshaw." "Uh-huh." She tapped a keyboard beneath his line of sight. Then, after a moment, looked back at him with nobody home eyes. "Do you have her passport and password?" Tooth gave her a smile. His best smile. "I guess she forgot to tell me I needed them." "What's your accent?" she asked. "American,"